Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to QSO. It's all about radio, ham radio, and shortwave radio. And our guest today is Chris Paul, NS2P. Our guest is Chris Paul, and his call is NS2P. And I want to welcome you on in. This fellow has, he's into a number of things, and we're just kind of going to get into it one thing at a time. So why don't you tell us where you're at so folks know what part of the country you're coming in from?
Okay, well, I'm in Rowlett, Texas. That's R-O-W-L-E-T-T, and that's a bedroom community basically of Dallas. It's northeast of Dallas, about 15 miles, 20 miles, which in Texas, with the distances we have here, that's considered a bedroom community. And I'm a fifth-generation Texan. Born and raised in Dallas and moved out here with my wife about 16 years ago to raise kids. So that's where I am.
So you're in the Dallas area, actually, is what it amounts to.
Yes, sir. Dallas area.
Well, originally, one of our shortwave transmitters that's with WTWW came from the Dallas area. And at that time, the station was known as KAIJ. I'm curious, had you ever heard of it?
I have not. Okay. Heard of KAIJ.
All right. It was owned originally by the Baptist Church there, and then later it was owned by Dr. Eugene Scott out of California. I'll learn how to talk tonight, you know, before it's over with. So,
definitely heard of Dr. Eugene Scott.
Yeah, I'll tell you, he was a character.
That's for sure.
I loved watching him teach, though, because if you could get past the hat and the cigar and the walking horses and the crazy music, he could really teach. He had a doctorate from Stanford, so he wasn't exactly a dummy. You know, he really wasn't. And if you listen close, he stayed pretty close to what I would consider to be, you know, kind of a conservative element. You know, all the rest of it was just flamboyant show, you know. And I got to know him pretty good. I was and when I found out he was a completely different character off of television than he was on TV. When I first met him, though, was at WMUZ in Detroit, and he was the head of a group called the Assemblies of God. And he was in Detroit holding a revival and revamping their Sunday school curriculum program. And I met him then, and he found out that my dad had passed probably a year or so before, and he stayed in contact with me for a long period of time. Every once in a while, I would hear from him. And what a lot of folks don't know, and that is he contributed a lot of money to orphanages, which he didn't want anybody to know. But he's passed now, so I can tell on him. And anyways, that was we'll get into that. But there's a lot of ministries located in Dallas. I know. I think, what is it, Kenneth Copeland's out there, and who else? I mean, there's a bunch of them out there. Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to the QSO Radio Show. We'll be right back with our guest, Dale Pruitt, K1 USA, right after this. Here at the QSO Radio Show, we really need to hear from you. Go to our website. Simply QSORadioShow.com. That's QSORadioShow.com. And you'll see all the past podcasts up there and other information. But go to the part where it says email Ted and send us an email. And be sure and put on that email, I want to win, because always giving something away. Go to the website. It's simply QSORadioShow.com and send us an email. And while you're at it, be sure and friend us on Facebook, QSO Radio Show, and follow us on Twitter, QSO Radio Show. And thank you for listening. One of the things we noticed at the Dayton Hamvention 2012 was the number of people that came up to the QSO radio booth and said, hey, I got my ticket by studying with Ham Test Online. My wife got her license through studying with Ham Test Online. My son got his ticket. All of my kids got their tickets with Ham Test Online. I mean, it went on and on and on. And there's a reason why. I mean, I've looked at all different kinds of study materials for getting your ham ticket. And either there's a rule, they're either cram sessions where you just memorize the answers, or they're so technical that you can get the ticket providing you want to study for the rest of your life. But Ham Test Online is kind of a perfect blend of that. In other words, they teach you. You actually learn the material. They give you pictures, simple descriptions, however. Rather than a book that rambles on and on and on and on about something, it's concise. It's to the point. It's where your mind can grasp it. And then when you see that question come around again on the test, you're ready for it because you've got a brief overview. I mean, you don't know all the technical implications of some mathematical formula, but you have a good idea on the concept, I want to say, of how something works or operates. Therefore, you know how to pick the right answer. Now, if, say, you're studying and you get the wrong answer, it will feed you back that question again and again and again. And finally, you can't help but learn it. You can go up to Ham Test Online and literally spend hours if you wish, and it doesn't bore you. You don't feel like you're not yawning like reading into a book or listening to a tape recording or something. It's a very unique experience. If you know someone that you'd like to see get their ticket, give them a gift certificate. Give them a membership to Ham Test Online. If you want to upgrade and get the next license up, enroll with Ham Test Online. Don't fool around. Don't waste your time. The technician ticket's only around $20 for like 2 years. You can't miss. Go to their website. It's so simple. HamTestOnline.com. That's HamTestOnline.com. Is it possible that a coffee roaster who has been blind from birth could make the best tasting coffee in the world? Well, I'm here to tell you that not only is it possible, but it's true. If you would like the most delightful, rich cup of coffee you have ever drank in your life, I'd like to invite you to visit the website of The Unseen Bean. That's The Unseen Bean, UNSEENBEAN, The Unseen Bean.com. Jerry Leary, amateur radio operator, shortwave listener, he is the owner of The Unseen Bean, one of the country's few blind coffee roasters. You will love his coffee. We want to invite you once again, go to his website, and that's theunseenbean.com. That's theunseenbean.com. Here at the QSO Radio Show, we really need to hear from you. Go to our website, simply QSOradioshow.com. That's QSOradioshow.com. And you'll see all the past podcasts up there and other information, but go to the part where it says email Ted and send us an email. And be sure and put on that email, I want to win, because always giving something away. Go to the website, it's simply QSOradioshow.com, and send us an email. And while you're at it, be sure and friend us on Facebook, QSO Radio Show, and follow us on Twitter, QSO Radio Show. And thank you for listening. You're listening to the QSO Radio Show. And now back to our guest, Chris Paul, NS2P.
Well, and it's certainly the Southern Baptist, their Southern Baptist Convention, I believe, is headquartered in Dallas. And, of course, one of the largest Baptist churches in the world, I presume. First Baptist Church of Dallas is here. You don't have to go far to find a church or a ministry in Texas. That's for sure.
Well, Dallas is, I guess I want to say years ago, the image was the television program with Larry Hagman and all of those folks. So when that thing was airing, what was going through your mind?
I wish everybody could see the supposed massive ranch that it was filmed at, which was not near as massive in person as most people think on TV. I wasn't a huge fan of the show, but I would watch it occasionally just for some of the outdoor shots to see where they were shooting. I was not real young, but certainly in my 20s or 30s at the time. And I live now maybe 10, 15 minutes from the South Fork Ranch, which is still a big going enterprise. What it's mainly used for is they do give tours of the original home there that was used for the outdoor shots. But mainly it's a large convention and event center. They have some big outdoor buildings, and well, in fact, my daughter just had a prom, went to a senior prom with a young man, and it was held at South Fork Ranch. But certainly not in the home. The home is maybe a 3,000-square-foot home, relatively modest home for that area nowadays, which has some large horse ranches around there. But I was never a huge fan of the show, but it was interesting to see where they were filming.
Well, yeah, but according to the show now, that place was huge, and everybody lived in that house.
Oh, of course, of course. And then you see the house, and you're thinking, there's no way everybody lived in this house. And it was, you know, some great editing, obviously, and I think Dallas was more than happy to have the recognition. I think for a lot of people and a lot of generation in Dallas, you know, I think for a long time, the only identity they had was Dallas Cowboys. And then before that generation, the only identity they really had was, unfortunately, the JFK assassination. So for a lot of Dallasites, that was a breath of fresh air, is seeing Dallas portrayed in a different light than just the place where our president was shot. So that was a breath of fresh air. And I think, and I'm not really sure, but I think that they actually tried to redo the show Dallas, or filmed a new series, or tried to film a new series. I wasn't plugged into all that, but I know that it had started up again, and people were excited that some of the original stars were back. And but as far as I know, none of those folks that were portrayed that played in the show Dallas actually lived in Dallas, or lived in Texas for that matter. But yeah, it's not far from me. It's about 15 miles north of me. Not far at all in this area.
Well, you know, I guess one of the things that was really interesting to watch is, if you were a little kid and you ever watched I Dream of Jeannie, seeing Larry Hagman in that role, and then watching him play this J.R. Ewing, and of course the accent was fake, but I would think the people in Dallas watching the television show would have heard his accent and said, oh, come on, let's do a little better than this. You know, I mean, he just wasn't Dallas. I mean, that accent, just, you know, he'd be talking to that Jock Ewing, and he called him Daddy. He said, well, Daddy, you know, I don't know. It just didn't fit. But I think he did a good job at the role. I really think he, you know, the facial expressions and all the things he got into, I think he did an excellent job of that. And but the storyline, of course, like everything else, they've got this one now about Nashville. And, I mean, they've got the rubber band stretched so far. If it ever breaks, it's going to kill somebody, you know. It's just really amazing. Well, let's switch gears. Heck with television programs at this point. Let's talk about ham radio. Before we get into something else, I'm just going to ask you, how what's the repeaters like in Dallas? I mean, one of the things I've noticed across the country, and that is, you can travel around the United States and check into a 2-meter repeater, and you're lucky. Just lucky if you get a response, and that's in a lot of places. Now, there are some pockets in this country where the amateur VHF bands are really active, and they're cool. So what's the story on Dallas?
I think, and all I can judge it on is based on my travels in the vehicle, which are mainly to Kansas, and the repeaters up and down I-35 going into Kansas, and then a couple times a year our family has a place in Colorado in Grand County, and I can base it on my travels there. I would say Dallas is probably as active or more active than most of the places that I've seen. Number of VHF and UHF repeaters, you know, I think one of the things that helped Dallas, well, my little town is a town of about 60,000 people, which may not be little for some parts of the country, but for this area, it certainly is, especially compared to Dallas. But my town itself has three repeaters. Now, they may it may be scarce if you get on there and drop your call. It may be, you may not hear much, but in the next town over, Garland or Dallas itself, pretty much any time, day or night, somebody will come back to you. And I think one of the things that helps Dallas is it's such a communications mecca. And whether that was in past generations or current generations, you know, past generations, you had Collins Radio here in Rockwell and E-Systems, and there's a whole lot of engineering folks that are also interested in ham radio. Certainly, I know a club that I'm a member of, Garland Amateur Radio Club. I think half the club seems to be retired RF engineers from Collins and Rockwell, as well as Raytheon. So there's a strong tech radio RF presence in the community, and I think that helps us quite a bit as far as repeater usage. But, you know, there are all times when you can drop a call, and like you said, you don't hear from anybody. I know traveling across the country, what I look for is colleges that have repeaters. You find a lot of colleges, and I don't know if it's part of their engineering program or what the situation is, but I find that if I can find a town that has a college repeater, that's the one to go to, because it seems like either it's the students or the faculty, somebody will answer you, somebody will talk with you and tell you a little bit about the repeater and why it's there. Now, I know my travels through Denver, they've got some excellent repeaters there and some excellent locations for those repeaters. So they have some great range on those repeaters. I know there's one in Boulder that's just amazing. I can, from our family cabin in Grand County, I can cross the Continental Divide and hit that repeater in Boulder without much problem, almost on a handheld, but usually I'll roll out a J-pole and can hit that repeater. So that's kind of the situation of repeaters. I want to say that they're better than most, but again, I haven't been in that many other big cities.
Well, tell us a little bit about this Triple H Net. I guess I know nothing about it, don't understand it, and I'm sure this is something that most folks that are in the hobby right now would very much like to find out more about.
Well, I would probably be one of the people least appropriate to comment, simply because I've only been participating in the Triple H Net about 2 weeks. And that's simply because I wanted to get my worked all states. I was a repeater rat, as I call them, forever on the local repeaters, and finally upgraded about a year and a half ago. Got my general and studied hard. Next month later, went back and got my extra class ticket, and then only started getting on HF probably about a month or two ago intently, And I knew I wanted to get my Workdall State certificate and looked around for nets, and had actually heard this net before. I was camping and didn't have a transmitter or transceiver with me. I just had a shortwave radio, listening a radio, and had heard this net late at night when I was up in the Colorado Rockies in a tent, and said, you know, I'm going to have to get on that net one of these days. And it's a net that's really for people that want to get their Workdall State certificate. This time of year, it starts at 0700 Zulu, which in my neck of the woods is 2 a.m., which is not easy for a lot of people, but the bands are pretty open then on 40 meter. Not real crowded. It meets every day of the year on 7.190 on the 40 meter band. It's open to any licensed ham that wants to jump on, and it's a great way to start getting contacts with all those states. I would imagine that in 2 weeks I went from not really keeping track and not really logging, I would just kind of rag to, but in 2 weeks I think I'm down to only needing about 12 states, and you know, have QSOs with Hawaii and QSOs with Alaska all through that net. And I think the net has been around at least 30 years, and some of the folks involved in the net have been there since the beginning. So it's a really neat way to, you know, a concentrated place to go on there, make your contacts, exchange some signal reports, and work toward that Workdall State certificate. They have a number of other awards they'll do. as well talking to state capitals. You can collect, there are a lot of members that come on there just in case you need that state. They've already got their certificate, but they still tune into the net to make contact with others. And there's some awards where you can collect worked all state certificate numbers if you make contact with those guys that already have their certificates. So that's how I got involved with it. It's just an easy way that you know people from around the United States are going to jump on there. We have a few DXers that come in. I've talked with a gentleman from Cuba. There's a gentleman from Australia that typically tunes in almost every morning. Some others like that. A gentleman from France that tunes in that also is trying to get his worked all states while he's in France. So it's a really interesting, I'd say, easy way to start working on that worked all state certificate, and that's why I became involved. And to be honest, I've only been involved for a couple of weeks.
How many states have you confirmed by working this Triple H net?
I've logged 36 states, mm-hmm. no, 38 states in about 2 weeks. And awaiting QSL cards from about half of those. Most of them confirmed, I log on QRZ. Some people are on that and some aren't. But the way Triple H works is they want physical cards. And for a relatively new extra class and a relatively new guy in HF, to me, getting QSL cards in the mail is still a treat. It's still Christmas.
Listen, let me tell you something. When I got my novice ticket, I couldn't wait to get home and get in front of that rig because I wanted more cards. I was like, I didn't even care about the contacts. I just wanted the cards, you know.
Oh yeah.
And if I got cards from one state or three cards from one city, I didn't care. That was just more cards to put up on the in the little plastic sleeves on the wall. There's something exciting and addictive about QSL cards, and it was
I hope it never goes out of style. And there's some folks that have said, you know, eQSLs are easier and logbook of the world, and you don't have to mess with the cards. I hope they never go out of style.
I think it'd be a crime.
Well, and you know, I think my wife, I'm no youngster, I'm 55 years old, and I get a QSL card in the mail. She says you're like a kid at Christmas, and I am. I definitely am, and I enjoy seeing, you know, different designs, and it's fun. And you're right, it is addicting, and you want to see that card, and I hope people want to see mine. So I put a little effort into mine, and I had them professionally printed, and you know, it cost you a little bit of postage, but you know, there's far more expensive ways to get kicks out of something than sending something through the mail to somebody. I opened up my mailbox today and got four of them.
Well, it sure.
That's a great day.
I know I'm going to get in trouble here. I'm going to go ahead and get in trouble. I don't care. sure beats stamp collecting. I can tell you that.
Yeah, I do. I collect stamps, but they're on the outside of the envelopes. My QSL cards come in.
I know, but I mean, I know guys that keep that collect stamps. They have these big stamp collections, and they have the little monocles over their eyes, and they're constantly picking these things up with tweezers. And oh, look at this! I got this, and some of them put them in books and all that kind of stuff. I don't understand it. I really don't. I say, hand me a D104 or a CW paddle, and now that's a hobby. Okay. Give me an antenna up in a tree somewhere. That's a hobby, okay?
Well, see, I don't get stamps, but then those people probably wouldn't get us with ham radio. So, you know, whatever floats your boat.
Okay, they'd say, yeah, well, you know, I can talk to Russia on my telephone, on my cell phone. And what, you want to talk to somebody you've never met before? Why would you want to do that? that's what you'll hear.
Exactly.
That's what you'll hear, yeah.
And I do hear it. You know, I've heard it from family members. Well, that's goofy. Why would you do that? Just pick up the phone. And it's hard to quantify to somebody or explain it. It's just not the same thing.
Well, what you got to learn to do is when they say to you, you know, when you tell them, you know, that what you're doing, and they look at you and they say, well, that's just goofy. Why would you want to do that? See, what you need to do then is you need to cross your eyes and start making weird grunting sounds, okay?
Yeah, but I do that anyway, so, you know, it doesn't work.
Well, you know, okay, how, explain this now. I know you've only been in this 2 weeks. This is exciting, though, because after 2 weeks, it seems like you've really got a grasp of this. Tell the folks out there that have never tried this, how do they check into the Triple H Net, and how does it work? Give us a little primer here for somebody that says, you know what, I think I want to try getting all, I want to try working all states.
You get your tube radio. Well, maybe most people don't have a tube radio, but I do. You get your old Kenwood hybrid radio warmed up.
Now is a tube radio the requirement?
No.
No?
No, it's just what I have.
Okay.
So I gotta get that heater tube warmed up for a couple minutes before I get on there. In Central Time, well, it's 0700 Zulu, so anybody else can figure out what that is for your time zone. But 0700 Zulu, 7.190 on the 40-meter band.
7.190.
Yep, 7.190. Net control station will come on, and they alternate. It's typically a group of, I think, six or seven, and they alternate depending on the morning.
Now give the Zulu times again here so the folks that are listening don't...
0700 Zulu.
Okay.
So if you're in the Central Time Zone under Daylight Savings Time or summertime, then it's at 0200 Central Time, but 0700 Zulu. So wherever you are in the United States, you can figure out what time to tune in there. And it's at 7.190 on the 40-meter band. And some nights are better than others. Some nights less noise than others. But you'll have net control will come on at 0700. They'll announce that this is the Triple H Net. And they will then ask for check-ins. And the check-ins are by call district numbers. So while I have a November Sierra 2 Papa is my call sign, I'm actually in the 5 calling district. And so they'll take check-ins by call district. You check into the net. They put you down. And then once they do that, depending on the day of the week, for instance, today is the 1st, they'll start with the 1st calling district for check-ins, and then they'll build a list, and they start at the top of the list, and they say, okay, November Sierra 2, Papa, Chris in Texas, who would you like to talk to? Now, what is very helpful is they use NetLogger, and if you go to netlogger.com, you can download NetLogger onto your computer and click that you want to monitor the Triple H Net so you can see the check-ins on your computer. And that way you can look at that and say, okay, well, I haven't talked to Hawaii yet, or I haven't logged the contact with Indiana or whatever. And you can kind of know, here's who I want to talk to when it's my turn. And you may very well, somebody may need Texas. So your call sign may come up long before your turn, and you log that contact. Typically, it goes for a couple hours, so I can't do it every night. I actually work during the day, so I can't spend every night on there. But it's really easy. We've had some folks in there that literally it's on a frequency that folks with their general ticket can use as well, which is really helpful because you don't have to have your extra class to get on 7.190 on single sideband on voice. And so we had some folks that have literally got their general ticket a couple days before, and this may be their first HF contact, and they hear about the Triple H Net and log in, and we walk them through it, and it's a very quick contact. You exchange signal reports. Net control confirms that you've both heard each other's signal report. They move on to the next contact. You get a QSL card in the mail to them. They send one to you, and you've got that logged. Once you've got all 50 states, you make copies of your card, you send it to Triple H Net, and you get a beautiful certificate. As they say, suitable for framing, which I plan on doing. I will definitely frame it.
Well, okay. Let me just ask this question. When you first start up in this, did you feel, I guess I want to say, a little intimidated, or did you feel a little... uneasy about checking in for the first time, or was it just natural?
I did not for the first time, but I'll tell you why, and it's because I lurked for a couple nights. I lurked and just listened, and I figured out, and I would suggest that most people do that. You know, I'm not an old Elmer here telling you I know everything, But to me, it just seems wise. If you're going to participate in a net, if you don't need on the net right then, you know, listen to the net. See how they work it. See how they do things. Every net's a little bit different. But I did. I lurked for a couple times. I got the NetLogger program. It's free to download. And they could actually see that I had logged into the NetLogger program, and they have a chat window, and they said, hey, NS2P, do you want to check in? I said, no, I'm just lurking. I just want to hear the net. They said, that's fine. Glad to have you. So I listened for a couple times before I dropped my call out there. And so it was not intimidating.
You're listening to QSO, and we're going to be right back with our guest, Chris Paul, NS2P, right after this. Here at the QSO Radio Show, we really need to hear from you. Go to our website, simply QSOradioshow.com. That's QSOradioshow.com. And you'll see all the past podcasts up there and other information. But go to the part where it says email Ted and send us an email. And be sure and put on that email, I want to win, because always giving something away. Go to the website. It's simply QSOradioshow.com and send us an email. And while you're at it, be sure and friend us on Facebook, QSO Radio Show, and follow us on Twitter, QSO Radio Show. And thank you for listening. One of the things we noticed at the Dayton Hamvention was the number of people that came up to the QSO Radio booth and said, hey, I got my ticket by studying with Ham Test Online. My wife got her license through studying with Ham Test Online. My son got his ticket. All of my kids got their tickets with Ham Test Online. And there's a reason why. I mean, I've looked at all different kinds of study materials for getting your ham ticket. And either they're cram sessions where you just memorize the answers, or they're so technical that you can get the ticket providing you want to study for the rest of your life. But Ham Test Online is kind of a perfect blend of that. In other words, they teach you. You actually learn the material. They give you pictures, simple descriptions, however. Rather than a book that rambles on and on and on and on, it's concise. It's to the point. It's where your mind can grasp it. And then when you see that question come around again on the test, you're ready for it, because you've got a brief overview. I mean, you don't know all the technical implications of some mathematical formula, but you have a good idea on the concept, I want to say, of how something works or operates. Therefore, you know how to pick the right answer. Hey, you're studying and you get the wrong answer. It will feed you back that question again and again and again. And finally, you can't help but learn it. You can go up to Ham Test Online and literally spend hours if you wish, and it doesn't bore you. You're not yawning like reading into a book or listening to a tape recording or something. It's a very unique experience. If you know someone that you'd like to see get their ticket, give them a gift certificate. Give them a membership to Ham Test Online. If you want to upgrade and get the next license up, enroll with Ham Test Online. Don't fool around. Don't waste your time. The technician ticket's only around $20 for like 2 years. You can't miss. Go to their website. It's so simple. HamTestOnline.com. That's HamTestOnline.com. Is it possible that a coffee roaster who has been blind from birth could make the best tasting coffee in the world? Well, I'm here to tell you that not only is it possible, but it's true. If you would like the most delightful, rich cup of coffee you have ever drank in your life, I'd like to invite you to visit the website of The Unseen Bean. That's The Unseen Bean, UNSEENBEAN, TheUnseenBean.com. Jerry Leary, amateur radio operator, shortwave listener, he is the owner of The Unseen Bean, one of the country's few blind coffee roasters. You will love his coffee. We want to invite you once again, go to his website, and that's TheUnseenBean.com. That's TheUnseenBean.com. Here at the QSO Radio Show, we really need to hear from you. Go to our website. Simply QSOradioshow.com. That's QSOradioshow.com. And you'll see all the past podcasts up there and other information. But go to the part where it says email Ted and send us an email. And be sure and put on that email, I want to win, because always giving something away. Go to the website. It's simply QSOradioshow.com and send us an email. And while you're at it, be sure and friend us on Facebook, QSO Radio Show, and follow us on Twitter, QSO Radio Show. And thank you for listening. You're listening to the QSO Radio Show. And now back to our guest, Chris Paul, NS2P.
Say to people that you don't even have to do that. This is a very informal, very easygoing net. They'll coach you along if they need to. It should not be intimidating to anybody. I think once they listen to the net, they'll quickly pick up on that you know, we're not talking about a Department of Homeland Security traffic net here. It's very easygoing.
Is there such a thing?
Probably.
I don't know. I just, you know.
I don't know.
Well, you know, this sounds really cool. It sounds like you've discovered something here that is unusual. Now, I had never heard of the Triple H net, so I'm completely ignorant of the whole thing. But this sounds like
there are other nets out there that do the same thing, that do the worked all states net. I know OMISS, OMISS net has been out there for probably just as long, if not longer.
I've heard of them. And well, the NetLogger program work on the Ole Miss nets.
Okay.
Will it? I was just asking. I don't know.
Oh, I don't know. It just depends on if they use that program or not. I think it would be difficult to participate in the net to me if you didn't have that, because otherwise you'd have to make. You'd be writing all those call signs down and making sure you got them right. And it's just so much easier if you have that net logger up running on your computer. And these days, most people have a computer right next to their radio gear. It seems like, at least. I know I do. And it's just so much easier because you can see the list there. And certainly if you're working on getting certain states, you can look and say, oh, There's a call from Pennsylvania. I need Pennsylvania. I need Idaho. And I'm saying that because I'm looking at the scratch pad that I had just from the other morning when I made contact with both those states, because I know I needed them. But I don't know if other nets use NetLogger. I know as the emergency coordinator for a fledgling Aries group, once we start our nets here in the next month, I know I will use NetLogger. It's a way that a net control can keep track of who's logged into the net, and also you can keep a physical record or a digital record to say who's logged into the net and who hadn't. And if you have a net that has some requirements, for instance, like an Aries group or a Racy's group or something like that, where you log attendance to a net, that's an excellent way to do that versus keeping a paper copy somewhere. But it's a great program, and again, it's free to download. I don't know the author. I would certainly give him credit if I could. But it's relatively intuitive to use and easy to use, and so that makes it very easy participating in the net as well. And again, there may be times when you're making a contact when the contact is so weak or there's so much noise, you may not be able to hear all of his call, and somebody, a net controller or a relay station, will say, hey, NS2P, so-and-so in Hawaii is calling you, and you may not be able to hear him enough to get his call sign even. However, if you listen right and tune a little bit, you might be able to hear him giving you a signal report, and that's what really counts. As long as you can hear the signal report and he can hear yours, they'll help you with the call signs, and they'll consider that a contact. So again, it's a very friendly net, and they want to help you get those states.
I want to ask you a question a little bit here about your CW attempts, or, you know, you said on your QRZ page that I still need to learn the code. I'm trying. How's that coming?
It's coming slowly. I wish I was 10 years old with an elastic mind. You know, they say young kids can learn new languages so easy. And I saw that with my kids as they were going through school, how easily they pick up on a language. But I think the older you get, the less plastic your mind is and elastic. So it's going slowly, but I'm going to do it. It's not a matter of me getting frustrated and quitting. I'm not going to quit. I'm going to get it done.
But well, you know, I mentioned something on the air on one of the shows here. I said, you know, I wish they would set aside a portion of the CW band, especially on 75 and 40 meters. Wouldn't hurt for them to do it on 15. But to designate a section that would be exactly like the old novice section. In other words, between here and here, these two points on the dial, is the slow learner's CW space. So people can get on there, I mean, just get on from the get-go. And even if they're creeping as slow as they possibly can, they don't have any fear of going too slow or somebody, you know, making fun of them or something. But I really think there needs to be a designated spot on the dial for that. And I think it needs to be declared public so that everybody knows, because I think everybody's in the same boat. Now, I've heard these people say, oh, you get on the CW band and some guy's going a little too fast, just tell him QRO. Well, you know what? I've heard those QSOs. I've listened. And a guy comes on, he's moving relatively slow, and then this guy comes back at 25, 30 words a minute. The guy says QRO, and what happens? The guy comes back 25, 30 words a minute. You know,
or doesn't come back at all.
Yeah, and it's almost like a certain smugness, you know. And I want to say that for those folks that do that kind of thing, you know, I hope your finals blow up, okay? I hope you lose the finals in your radio and you're off the air for QRT for an indefinite period of time. I think that is so hopelessly rude and insulting to the entire amateur radio community because everybody started slow.
Well, nobody exactly. Started. Everybody was at 5 words per minute at one point in their time.
There you go.
So, but I think everybody's been there.
I think to promote CW, it would be a good thing if we somehow through the ARRL and the FCC or whatever declared a spot on every dial to be the sacred spot where you can get on, and if you can only do 3 words a minute, by gosh, get on there and do your 3 words a minute. And the people that have a heart for it will go down there and they'll work with those people.
Well, that's exactly right, because there are some people out there that will bend over backwards and do absolutely everything to help you learn the code. I know there's some clubs that run some, I don't know if they're weekly, but I knew of one I just happened across and was in Denton, Texas, which is the home of North Texas State University. Well, nowadays they call it University of North Texas. I was up there actually for a dance contest for my daughter, and you can only, I mean, no insult to dance contest. I don't want to get in trouble here, but after about 6 hours, you need a break. So I walked out to the car and just got on the local net there and heard them talking about their experiences with the net they had the evening before that they put on once a week for people learning code. And I thought, that is a great idea. That's an excellent idea. And this gentleman was just a devotee of CW and wanted to get as many people as he knew or that had patience to learn to get on there and learn code. And he would practice with these folks and they'd take turns sending and, you know, nobody was too slow. And that's why they were just raving and thanking him about that on the net. But I agree. And to be honest, I love the idea of code, because I love the idea of QRP. And I'm an outdoorsman, and I like to backpack, and I like to hike. And I would love to be able to take a little QRP CW rig with me, throw up a wire, and make some contacts. That, to me, is a goal, and that's why I'm learning CW. I don't really hope to be a contester with CW. Who knows, that may happen sometime in the future. But my first goal is to just be able to communicate well enough that I'll feel comfortable taking a little QRP CW rig in the woods with me. So that's the immediate goal with CW for me. And I've got 2 or 3 different training programs, and each of them use a little different methods to teach, and it's just going slowly. You know, as a married guy with 2 kids and a job and different things and a lot of community involvement, you know, it's just hard to carve out time every day to practice your CW, which is what you got to do.
Well, I think that it would make it a lot easier on everyone involved if we got on and were able, the people that were wanting to learn the code. Now, see, during my tenure, you had to have 13 words a minute for the general class, you know. And that could be a rough test, even at 13, and I can tell you why. Because if you took the test at one of the FCC buildings, they were in a federal building, generally marble walls and a lot of glass, so the echo was just unbelievable. You know, you couldn't tell a dit from a da. I mean, it was pretty bad. And, of course, depending on where you were sitting, if you were in the back of the room, it was bad. If you were up close to the code oscillator, it wasn't quite as bad, you know. So,
well, never having to do that, is that how they did that? You would go in a room and they would play code or play a recording and you would have to copy and then they'd grade you? Is that how that was done?
Right. Where I took it was in the Detroit field office, and I had to sit and copy. I don't know how much you were supposed to copy, and then you had to have obviously a certain percentage of it right. And then you had to get on a straight key, and you had to send. Well, sending was never a problem. I could send 30 words a minute on a hand key, you know. I just couldn't hear it, you know. I mean, I could hear whatever I was hearing, but it wasn't that. And that's how it was at that time. Now, they changed it. I mean, it's been different at different times, but at the time that I took it, the code was sent off of a machine that had like a paper tape running through it, and it was like had little perforations in it or something, and that created the code. And it was very mechanical sounding. I mean, it did not sound human at all. But
like a player piano.
Yeah, exactly. It was exactly the way it was. And a friend of mine noticed this, and he pointed it out to me, and I noticed the same thing as well. When you went into the FCC office to take a written test, they would announce publicly in the room, they would call the person's name, and they would say, you have failed. Okay. And of course, everybody looked around, you know, and then the guys that passed, they'd say, so-and-so, could you come up here just for a moment? And as you went up, they would kind of whisper in your ear, you passed. I know that.
If you fail, though, you have to take the walk of shame out of it.
Yeah, exactly. You have failed, you know, was what they did. You know, I was like, whoo, you know. And I can, you know, that those words were just like, make your skin crawl if it would. I mean, even if it wasn't you, and I never failed an exam at an FCC office, but I felt sorry for folks that did, because there's a lot of people that go to take a test and they really know the material, but they get nervous, you know, and they tend to get in a hurry and nervous, and they miss a bunch of questions that they really know the answers to. Matter of fact, I've actually seen this done. If you ran into a kind person doing the test, you could take the test, and then I think you could, if they graded it and they knew you failed, it used to be like there was a waiting period before you could take it again. But there were some times when they would just go ahead and reissue a test on the spot, and you could test one more time. And generally, the people would pass it every time. It's just that they had to relax. They had to go through that and just kind of get nervous and screw it up, and then after that they were good to go. And that was kind of a different thing. But that, you have failed. Oh me. Anyhow, so we've covered this Triple H net, which sounds really cool. 7.190 at 0700 hours Zulu. You know, it's kind of interesting. I've always wondered who the Zulu people were that came up with this time situation. I mean, I've never... Well, have you ever met a Zulu before? Have you ever seen a Zulu? Anyhow...
I actually do know a Zulu. Would you call them a Zulu American? I mean, they live in America now, but they are Zulu. But they ought to get paid royalties or something. I mean, because their tribal name is used all the time in ham radio. You would think they'd get something out of it. But
I think the United States government should be selling spot commercials on WWV, okay? I really do. The time is brought to you by, you know, and that can go right into the government coffers there. So they could be making lots of money on WWV. They have to have a big voice announcer do the ID on the top of the hour, because the guy on there he's kind of puny. They need some guy with a big voice. Says, this is WWV, you know, and then, you know, WWV brought to you by. You know. Oh, well, anyhow. tell us about your beginnings in ham radio. How did you even hear about this thing called ham radio?
Well, as a kid, at the time, one of the few years I was actually not living in Dallas, I was living in San Antonio, Texas, and there was a kid that lived across the street from us. He was maybe a couple years older than I was, and he was the quote weird kid of the neighborhood. But for some reason, he and I got along, which probably speaks volumes about me. But this weird kid was into ham radio. And I visited him, and he was always had his room was strewn with wires and tubes and soldering irons, half of which were hot, and he didn't know it. And he was in his room either building something or sending CW over the air. And I thought at that time, you know, that's really cool. He's talking to people in other countries. And he was maybe 13, 14 years old, and I just thought that was the neatest thing in the world. And it kind of, you know, it went away. Other interest in playing sports, and I was in the military for a while, and I'd always heard of ham radio. It was always interesting to me. But then I became involved in a couple of local volunteer groups here in my city, one of which is the Community Emergency Response Team, which is organized under their Citizens Corps Councils, which is a FEMA group, and we basically were trained volunteers that assist police and fire when they are stretched to the limit or beyond the limit. And in Texas, the type of catastrophic events we'd be called out for are straight-line winds or flooding or, God forbid, tornadoes, which we see our share of course, in Texas. But at the time, I realized, you know what, something that would really go hand-in-hand with that is two-way radio and ham radio. And so I went and got my technician's license, and of course there was no code when I got that, which was about 5-6 years ago, I guess. I got my technician's license, and I mainly was interested in ham radio for the emergency response aspect. I was in a member of a local races group for a while, and that's why that was my initial interest in ham radio. It wasn't HF at all. In fact, it really didn't interest me at all at the time. And then as years went by, and as I said, I was a repeater rat for a while and got involved with a couple local clubs and saw, you know, the HF world opened up. And I said, you know, that would really be interesting. And the fact is that, you know, if, God forbid, something catastrophic did happen and tornadoes hit and cell towers are down and electricity is out, you know, those guys may need to speak to Austin, our local state emergency office in Austin, which is our state capital. Well, they're not going to do that on repeaters. They're not going to do that, you know, on VHF or UHF. And that's where I became interested in ARIES and the HF aspect of it. Not saying ARIES is HF only. Of course, they're not. But that's how I got interested in HF. My rig is half my age, at least. I bought it at a local hamcom here in the Dallas area. It's a Kenwood TS-530S. I'm looking at it right now. I've also got a TS-520S. And people said, "Well, good Lord, you're going to start in HF, and you're going to start with a hybrid radio, and you got to peak the drive and dip the plate and all that. That's crazy. Why would you want to learn all that?" Well, to me, that's just as interesting as the contacts is how that works. So I don't even have a solid state radio. I've got an old tube radio.
Well, I'll tell you something.
Works great for me.
I've got several Drakes here, TR4Cs, and I've got a T4XC and an R4C receiver, and I've got an old Yaesu. What is that thing? 101ZD. That's a hybrid radio that's got a couple of 6146s in the final. I don't know. Personally, myself, I get a big bang out of the old radios. Some of the new ones, yeah, they sound nice, but they don't have much personality. You know, I mean, these things have got... TS-520 is a magic radio. And let me say this. There's a lot of people have asked me, you know, about Kenwood. And let me just say this. The radios, I think, are excellent. I have no problem with the Kenwood radios. I have a problem with the people that represents Kenwood here in the United States. And the reason why I say that, and you'll have to excuse me, because when people talk about Kenwood, I usually have to say this. I went to the Dayton Hamvention here back a few years ago, and I had a few radios that had been given to me by Ronnie Millsap, WB4KCG. And several of them didn't work. One was a TS-930. So I went over to the Kenwood booth, and I said, I'd like to find out how I could go about getting this radio fixed. Now, I'm paranoid about going in it because of who it belonged to and because I could be a bull in a china shop. I'm just not familiar with it. Now, I understand the TS-930 is an old radio. I know that, okay? But I also know that there's several guys around the country that are experts at working on TS-520s. There's sure. several guys around the country that are experts at working on the TR-4Cs and the Drake radios. You know, and so anyways, I went up to one of the fellas and I said, what could I do to get... Oh, we don't make that radio anymore. You can't find parts for it. Just throw it in the trash can. I said, whoa, really? You know?
Well, but they're in the business of selling new radios.
Well, they may be. They may be. But that is a really horrible thing to do to someone who's trying... And so I tried to explain. I said, I want to restore it. There's got to be somebody that can bring this thing back up, because what we actually wanted to do was to set a thing up at the Country Music Hall of Fame where hams from around the country could come in and operate these radios that had belonged at one time to Ronnie Millsap, Chet Atkins. You know, I mean, I think that would be just so cool, you know. So I walked over and I just decided I ain't going to talk to this guy anymore. So I walked over and I talked to the other fellow that was out there, and you know, and he was just as rude, if not ruder, and ordered me out of the Kenwood booth. Because I asked him, I said, what in the world is all of the, what did I use, the word arrogance? I said, what's all the arrogance about? He said, are you calling me arrogant? I said, no, sir, you are arrogant. And he said, you get the blankety blank out of my booth, and did that in front of a whole bunch of people. So from that point on, I said, you know what? I can live without Kenwood. Period. You know, there is no reason, especially when you're talking about a historic ham radio operator, a guy like Ronnie Millsap, blind from birth, gets his ham ticket and has become a super country music star. And he's, you know, and these radios could, these things mean something to people, okay? Now, and I have to finish the story by saying when I walked over to the ICOM booth, because I had a couple of 751s that needed repair, and I honestly cringed when I walked in because I didn't know, maybe it was somebody's going to pull out a baseball bat or something, you know. But I ran into Ray and his people, and as soon as I said Millsap, the woman standing there, and I don't remember what her name was or call sign, she says, oh, WB4KCG. I said, yep. I said, you got that right. And they told me, put them in boxes and send them. We'll take care of it for you. Can you believe that? I just thought, now, you know what? I don't have a Kenwood radio in the shack, and I would not have one. Now, I'm not telling you that you need to live like that, because there's nothing wrong with the radios. The radios are great. I mean, they're incredible rigs. The 520, my goodness. I mean, that TS-520 was so far ahead of its time when it came out. Because I had a Yaesu 101 EE, and man, after I heard my friends Kenwood, I figured I bought the wrong rig, you know. But anyways, I have never shared the story on the air. It's been up on the website, but it's just been in my craw for so long. I think that any time someone is doing something to promote the hobby, everybody ought to be on board, just like Ray Novak from ICOM, right away. Sure, we'll help you. We'll do whatever we can. You know, I wasn't asking for blood. I was just asking for a little help, you know, because I figured I know out there somewhere in the bushes is this guy that works on 930s. I know he's there, you know. And then after that happened, I had several people email me and say, here's the name of a guy that works on the TS-930s. And I've contacted one fella. And he got it going just bam. You know, I mean, I sent it to him. He sent it right back. He said, oh, it was just simple. You know, so anyways, there's my soapbox. I probably scared you now. So anyways.
Well, the fact that you remember that story or you remember that incident and you'll never forget it, that's something that they didn't figure on. And that's just so short-sighted on their part. You know, and to be honest, I knew nothing of their reputation. What I knew was I was looking for an HF rig. I knew I didn't want to buy new. I knew it was going to be for my home, so it wasn't going to be one of these tiny little backpack radios, which I'll own at some point. But I got on the internet, I got on different websites, and I looked for the threads that said, or the forums on the threads that said, you know, the best radio for this price. And people said, well, you know, if you can find one in good shape, find a PS530S or the 830 or even the 520. And it just so happened a couple weeks later, I was at the swap meet part of the HamCon up here in Dallas, and a gentleman was there, and he was actually had the radio that I'm looking at right now, had it set up with a portable antenna, and he had a for sale sign on it. And I said, you're operating it? You got it for sale? And he goes, well, that's, I just want to prove to people it works. And I went, well, you know what? You proved it to me. What do you want? And we haggled a little bit about it, and I came home with a radio. Now, since then, I added a matching tuner, and I added the matching external speaker. I've got a friend that wants me to sell me a matching station monitor, so I might just go all the way. But that's my only reputation with Kenwood. And like you said, I know that there are folks out there that specialize in reconditioning these things and, you know, putting all new capacitors in them. And, of course, it just like your, I think you said, Yaesu uses the 6146 tubes. That's what this uses. They're still readily available for now, knock on wood. In fact, I probably ought to go buy two or three just to keep them. But that's how I got into it. But, you know, the fact that you remember that story, it would behoove those factory reps to know some folks in the United States that do specialize in redoing those Kenwood radios.
Or how about this?
So they can refer people like you and say, well, call so-and-so.
Yeah, but how about this? Ted, you know what? That radio is so old, and you know, I wish I could help you, but I just don't know what direction to point you in. How about just that, you know?
How easy is that?
You know?
It's easier to do that than take all the extra effort to chase you out of the booth.
I've got a TS-430 sitting here. I don't know anything about that radio. I had it hooked up, was using it for a long time. It worked fine, had great receive on it, good clean audio on the transmit, but it's out of here. I don't want anything in my shack with the name Kenwood on it, period. Yep. And I believe I have to do that in order to settle the score. And for all the folks that have those rigs, those Kenwood rigs, you've got fine radios. There's no doubt about it. Man, I remember the first time I heard a TS-520. Like I said, I had bought a Yaesu 101E. Now, Yaesu today is a whole different ballpark than that radio. But I had it, and I remember I went to a friend's house, a matter of fact, a blind ham that lived out in St. Charles, Michigan. His call sign was WB8TTA. And I went out there, and he turned on his 520, and I sat and listened to that receiver, and I was so envious it just about ate a hole through me. That was the slickest, easiest to listen to, smooth-sounding, selective receiver I had heard. It made my Yaesu sounded like a CB radio sitting next to that thing, you know. And finally, I wound up getting a TS-520 years ago. Matter of fact, I've got three of them in the house, and not a one of them works. But that's because they're 90 years old, and, you know, and I haven't had a chance to work on them or fix them. But the radios that we were wanting to put in the Country Music Hall of Fame, and we're still going to do this. It's just a matter of time to have a station set up in there so that, say, when you come into Nashville, you can go over there and reserve the station and sit down and operate, you know, on a radio that belonged to somebody in the country music business. And I don't know who all. There may be more folks in it. I really don't know. But now let me ask you this question. Let's move along to Aries. Now, folks that don't know what Aries is, I know there's people out there listening that have absolutely no idea. They've heard the name. They know that they've seen it in print. they've seen stories written up that has something to do with Aries and emergencies and all that kind of thing. So I'm going to let you explain from the ground floor exactly what Aries is and how a person, if they're a ham, how they can get involved in Aries.
Well, Aries, of course, is a group of the ARRL, American Radio Relay League. And Aries is, in many cases, Aries groups are affiliated with or they just switch hats with Racy's groups. But it's licensed amateurs, volunteers who register their equipment and their qualifications with a local Aries group. And they do much the same role as many of the Aries groups do for communications duty. And that communications could be VHF, UHF, could be HF. It could be, you know, even if you don't need DHF, VHF, or UHF, one thing that's reiterated over and over in Aries is you're a communicator first. That may or may not involve a radio. If you're helping out the local Red Cross or the local hospital that's got a power outage, they may need you on cell phones. If that's the case, then that's what you do. But it's certainly the only requirement for membership is that you're a licensed amateur radio operator with the FCC. There's typically, I've never heard of an Aries group that has a cost to join. There certainly is no cost with our group. One of the reasons that we do have a local Racy's group, and one of the reasons that we started an Aries group, is Racy's is typically tied to a city's fire department, police department, or emergency management group. And while they very well may have nets and practice sessions, they can only be activated by those city or civic sponsors, whereas an Aries group can activate pretty much whenever they want to activate. So you are available to help in many more community events than typically a Racy's group can be.
You're listening to QSO, and we're going to be right back with our guest, Chris Paul, NS2P, right after this. Here at the QSO Radio Show, we really need to hear from you. Go to our website, simply QSOradioshow.com. That's QSOradioshow.com. And you'll see all the past podcasts up there and other information. But go to the part where it says email Ted and send us an email. And be sure and put on that email, I want to win, because always giving something away. Go to the website. It's simply QSOradioshow.com and send us an email. And while you're at it, be sure and friend us on Facebook, QSO Radio Show, and follow us on Twitter, QSO Radio Show. And thank you for listening. One of the things we noticed at the Dayton Hamvention was the number of people that came up to the QSO radio booth and said, hey, I got my ticket by studying with Ham Test Online. My wife got her license through studying with Ham Test Online. My son got his ticket. All of my kids got their tickets with Ham Test Online. And there's a reason why. I mean, I've looked at all different kinds of study materials for getting your ham ticket. And either they're cram sessions where you just memorize the answers, or they're so technical that you can get the ticket providing you want to study for the rest of your life. But Ham Test Online is kind of a perfect blend of that. In other words, they teach you. You actually learn the material. They give you pictures, simple descriptions, however. Rather than a book that rambles on and on and on and on, it's concise. It's to the point. It's where your mind can grasp it. And then when you see that question come around again on the test, you're ready for it because you've got a brief overview. I mean, you don't know all the technical implications of some mathematical formula, but you have a good idea on the concept, I want to say, of how something works or operates. Therefore, you know how to pick the right answer. Hey, you're studying and you get the wrong answer. It will feed you back that question again and again and again. And finally, you can't help but learn it. You can go up to Ham Test Online and literally spend hours if you wish, and it doesn't bore you. You're not yawning like reading into a book or listening to a tape recording or something. It's a very unique experience. If you know someone that you'd like to see get their ticket, give them a gift certificate. Give them a membership to Ham Test Online. If you want to upgrade and get the next license up, Enroll with Ham Test Online. Don't fool around. Don't waste your time. The technician ticket's only around $20 for like 2 years. You can't miss. Go to their website. It's so simple. HamTestOnline.com. That's HamTestOnline.com. Is it possible that a coffee roaster who has been blind from birth could make the best tasting coffee in the world? Well, I'm here to tell you that not only is it possible, but it's true. If you would like the most delightful, rich cup of coffee you have ever drank in your life, I'd like to invite you to visit the website of The Unseen Bean. That's The Unseen Bean, UNSEENBEAN, TheUnseenBean.com. Jerry Leary, amateur radio operator, shortwave listener, he is the owner of The Unseen Bean, one of the country's few blind coffee roasters. You will love his coffee. We want to invite you once again, go to his website, and that's theunseenbean.com. That's theunseenbean.com. Here at the QSL Radio Show, we really need to hear from you. Go to our website, simply QSOradioshow.com. That's QSOradioshow.com. And you'll see all the past podcasts up there. And other information, but go to the part where it says email Ted and send us an email. And be sure and put on that email, I want to win, because always giving something away. Go to the website, it's simply QSOradioshow.com, and send us an email. And while you're at it, be sure and friend us on Facebook, QSO Radio Show, and follow us on Twitter, QSO Radio Show. And thank you for listening. You're listening to the QSO Radio Show. And now back to our guest, Chris Paul, NS2P.
This is in no way to degenerate or to denigrate races at all. It just can often be two totally different requirements or different instances in the local community when either can be used. And as I said, a lot of groups are dual hat. They're both races and Aries. I became interested in more Aries simply because of the HF capabilities. If a tornado tears through Dallas-Fort Worth and throws cell towers into New Mexico, there's a good chance that a lot of repeaters will be off the air. We can fire up a generator, get an HF rig, and talk to Austin without a problem, or another state if need be. So that's what Aries is. There's a great they have some great publications on emergency communications on the ARRL website. Their field resources manual is one of the best things I've ever seen written for emergency communications. And in fact, just recently, the Department of Homeland Security has designated Aries as their go-to volunteer communications group. Not putting Races by the side by any means, but saying, you know, we want to do more with Aries, which, if I haven't said it already, stands for Amateur Radio Emergency Service. I probably should have said that from the beginning.
Well, let me ask a question. A local Aries group. Okay, so what I'm hearing, though, is kind of nebulous. I mean, here's what I want to know. Is it's a local group. Do they meet? Do they have some place that's kind of like their, you know, like their headquarters or... is there any, community involvement where, let's say, all the hams together invest in an Aries station, or I've seen these communications trailers that people have, you know. Is that all part of Aries, or is that just strictly the Races people doing all that? How does that work?
Ted, is totally dependent on the Aries group. And we're fortunate that in our Aries group, in our area, the Rowlett Aries group, we were given a small grant to get started by our local Rowlett Citizens Corps Council, which will allow us to have some Aries group-owned equipment. But I think, similar to Races group, a Races group may have a full communications trailer, or a Races group may have, you know, a half dozen guys with handhelds. It's just totally dependent upon that group and, you know, the strength of the leadership and of all these, whether it's Aries or Races, all these are so dependent upon the support from the local community, whether that be a civic organization, the actual city itself or county. Without that support, it's just you're paddling upstream. We're fortunate in Rowlett that our police and fire, and we have an emergency manager that he's studying to get his ticket. But we're fortunate that we have such great support from those folks, and they realize that we are an asset to the community, and that has helped make the community a storm ready community, which we are. As far as what they have and what they have to offer, it's totally dependent upon each group. Our goal is to be HF ready if need be. Most of our members, or I would say all of our members, already have a VHF and UHF capability. We have a local repeater that was under the under the ownership of the Rowlett Citizens Corps Council. It used to be part of a local amateur radio club, which has gone by the wayside. But we may have enough interest that we can start that club again, too. But our main focus is emergency communications and learning more about emergency communications, because, you know, no matter how long you've been an amateur radio operator, there's always something new to learn. And somebody else has figured something out that you're puzzled by, and somebody else does it a little bit better that you can learn from. I am by no means, as the emergency coordinator, which in an ARES or amateur radio emergency service, the emergency coordinator is the de facto head or the leadership of the group. I did that because I have the extra class license. I have taken the emergency communications course offered by the ARRL, which is an online course, and is no walk in the park. It's not something you're going to knock out in an hour or two. It took me probably an hour or two a day over about a month to get that course done, but it's a great course. I had that under my belt already. Some local leadership said, hey, we want to start a ARRES group, and I said, yeah, I'll be the emergency coordinator. So I am by no means the most technically proficient of the group. I'm sure of that. But I'm hoping that those folks with their technical expertise will get us that much further down the road. I'm just the guy trying to herd the cats. And I know some of those cats will be far more technically savvy than I am. But we're a fledgling group, relatively new. And we've got a whole 8 members already, so we're getting there.
Now, I guess the question is, now, does your group, do you have meetings?
Our goal is to have just a couple meetings a year, but our goal is to have a drill every quarter, a full-fledged drill. And whether that drill be using the local repeater, or that drill is a quasi-emergency with the local hospital where we set up in their parking lot, with HF communication capabilities for them. It might be helping support the city with some civic event. You know, we have a pretty involved city with some great activities that oftentimes require, or don't require, but would be helped by some folks with amateur communication that maybe the Racy's group couldn't handle or is doing something else, and we hope to be involved in that. But we have a monthly net on the air, just so everybody can check in and make sure the repeater and everything else is working out. The repeater, of course, is open to the public during non-net times. But I think you'll find with any ARRES group, and the ARRL is relatively loose with requirements, as far as that they're not coming along saying you must have a drill every month. You must log that drill. The section emergency coordinator for ARRL is certainly interested in the hours that the folks have put in, the volunteer hours, because they do track that. And that's just to show that the state or the city, state, and federal leaders, you've got these volunteers out here that are willing to put in these hours, and this is why amateur radio is important.
Well, I guess I was thinking that if you had meetings, let's say monthly meetings, you know, and even maybe something like a potluck dinner or meet at a restaurant somewhere once a month for dinner and everybody gets together. It just seems like that would knit the group together all that much more. And then have a net, you know, like a once a month net, once a week net, I don't know, whatever it would suit the fancy. But I think
that's a great idea, and we may very well get there. Just we're kind of fledgling and one foot in front of the other right now. I know our goal is to have this as an emergency service you know, amateur radio emergency service, and that is our priority. You know, later down the line, we may form a separate club for the social aspect of it, but our goal, first and foremost, is going to be emergency communications and service to the community. Now, if that's helped by having more meetings than not, or gatherings at a restaurant or meet for breakfast or something, I mean, we're certainly going to be open to that. But again, the goal is going to be providing that emergency communications and continuing to learn on our, you know, ourselves, whether it be passing traffic. You know, if we need to learn code, we can learn code, and but we also want to get more people interested in ham radio. You know, as part of the ARRL Field Day, which we will have. This will be our first year. As you know, we hope to get some people walking by and wondering what the heck are those guys doing over there under the tent. Oh, they're talking on amateur radio. Well, let's check that out, and certainly let them know that we're going to sponsor some technician courses, you know, over the next year. We hope to sponsor two or three technician courses. We've got a local instructor that has a pass rate, I think, of about 98% on the first try. And he comes in and teaches a course over a weekend, and then Sunday afternoon you take the test, and boom, you've got a bunch of new hams. So anything we can do to further emergency communications, as well as get other people interested in amateur radio.
You know, I was going to say I know that there was one Aries group that I was talking to that told me that during some particular thing, I forget what it was, he said, you know, of course, a lot of these guys were looking for something very glamorous to do or something real attention-getting, but he did say that during their time of crisis, their Aries group was responsible for Meals on Wheels. And I thought, that is cool. I don't care what anybody says. That's cool. Can you imagine, you know, a senior citizen sitting there stranded in their apartment or in their high rise or wherever they're at, you know, and here's a bunch of hams come pulling up and delivering Meals on Wheels. I mean, I thought that's cool. That is so cool because evidently either the weather or something was wrong to where they didn't want the general public out doing things, you know, in after the either a flood or something. I don't remember what it was, but that's what they were involved in, you know. And I thought, you know, that is just absolutely super cool. And I guess, you know, I've heard of Aries groups being involved in parades and providing assistant communications to the normal flow of things. Like, for example, there would be a ham with somebody from the actual parade group or whatever, and they would be together, so the ham would have the communications device so they could communicate back and forth. So what my impression was that Aries is very, very diversified. In other words, it's not just weather, you know, it's a number of things that
exactly right. Whatever we can do to further and bolster the communications within the city. And, you know, I think, you may be a situation where you need to sustain yourself as an Aries group. If you can't get in the grocery stores or there's no power, you know, do you have the capabilities to provide power to your rigs? Do you have the solar panels to charge batteries? And it's a great learning curve. You know, so many of us are used to coming in our house and turning on the lights, and we've got power, and we can hit the button on our radios and be up on the air. Well, what if you don't have that power? What do you do then? And it may very well be the only communication for a city or an area, if the catastrophe is big enough. Or it could be something as simple as the city, like you said, that needs help with a parade. There's a local event that's happening in this area in a couple weeks that's going to be a 3-day bicycle ride. Well, they need folks in the swag wagons or shag wagons. There's some vans that follow along behind the guys and pick up the riders that just can't make it anymore. And you need to account for all those people. And you need people that can communicate. And it may not be in a cell area because it's in some rural parts of Texas where cell coverage can be a little bit spotty. No matter what AT&T and Verizon tells you, there's some parts of Texas you can go to where you're just not going to get a signal.
Well, that's all over the country. I mean, that's not just in Texas. It's everywhere.
Oh, sure.
And, there's events that take place out in the community in areas where the cell phones just don't work. Well, I'm going to tell you something. You have somebody in an event of some kind in an area where the cell is just not functioning. And I'll tell you another place where the cells act up a lot, and that is during during things like public gatherings like football games or parades or public events where there's so many people in the area that the cell phone just jams up and you can't dial out, you can't get anything. Well, you get an injury in that area and you need an ambulance or something. There's your Aries people. They got a radio and they can get that ambulance there pronto, where everybody's dialing on their cell phone and they can't get anything to happen. You know, I was in an area here just right where we're at near Lebanon, Tennessee. We got this horrendous snowstorm that just started all of a sudden. And I was traveling down I-40. We couldn't make a single phone call to anybody. Everybody was on their cell phones and none of the cell phones were working. So we depend on this technology, and sometimes you got to step back a minute and realize just exactly how vulnerable it is. And then I was talking to my cousin, who is in Clarksville, Tennessee, who was part of the Clarksville Police Department, and I asked him, I said, what's your opinion on these ham operators that operate during emergencies and stuff? And he said, oh, man, he says, we've had our whole communication system go completely down. And he said, and for no reason that we knew of. And he said, if it wasn't for the hams riding along in the cars, he said, we wouldn't have had any radio, period.
Sure.
So, you know, you just never know exactly. And then, of course, our good friend Alan Pitts, who is the former public relations manager of the ARRL, and he did such a fine job of these press releases. It would come out and it would talk about all the different times and places and things that hams have done during an emergency. They got published in a newspaper or got a television story on it or something like that. And I see that as being a total asset from the standpoint that this is the reason why the FCC has to look at our hobby and say, look at what these people are doing. Look what they do. You know, and then we don't have to worry about ever losing our frequencies or whatnot, because we serve the public with things that really matter, if that makes any sense at all.
Well, and I think it's a constant battle. I'm certainly not an expert in frequency spectrum, but you know, it's a constant battle and it will continue to be. And groups like ARRL are out there, and they do have the lobbyists that walk the halls with, you know, in Congress and the Senate, and make sure that ham radio operators get their fair shake and get some protection on that spectrum, because it's a constant battle. You mentioned in an emergency, you know, the old cliche is when all else fails, you know, there's always ham radio, and that's what we want to be, is when all else fails, they know they can reach out. And you know, I think I read, I think it was actually on the ARRL website just a couple of days ago, of a couple that were on a boat, on a sailing yacht, that ran into trouble and not only had an emergency with the boat, I don't know if it was demasted or what the situation was. I know they had a problem with the boat. At the same time, they had problems with health. Somebody on the boat was injured. The craft was injured. But they had an HF rig, and they were able to reach an operator, I believe, in Indonesia, who relayed that to a government group. And the country of Indonesia could not reach these people, so they had to go back to this amateur radio operator, and he was the de facto rescue expert or communications expert for these folks on this boat. And they were able to get a commercial shipping vessel over to them to get them picked up, where they were then helicoptered for medical treatment. But, you know, it was just some guy on his radio who heard the call and answered the call to help. And, you know, it's those kind of things that you can't put a price on. And they only happen because the amateur radio and the groups out there like ARRL have protected that spectrum. And that's what make amateur radio still a viable option.
Well, you know, I've been in ham radio a long time, and I'm not aware of any other group other than the ARRL that is responsible for lobbying and keeping the bans for the hobby. I don't know of anybody else. The ARRL is the only group I know of.
Well, I'm relatively new in the hobby, and you know what? I'm almost hesitant to even use the word hobby sometimes because and you probably know where I'm coming from. I think it's more important than just a hobby. Now, for a lot of folks, it is just a hobby. But I think it provides such a service on so many levels, and the general public doesn't know that. And I think it's up to us, the amateur radio operators, and I'm saying this as a brand new guy, well, not brand new, but 4 or 5 years in the service. I think it's up to us to let people know how important it is. And, you know, exactly as I said, when all else fails, what are you going to do? When that cell phone doesn't work, those landlines don't work, you know, the TV stations are off the air, how are you going to get message out? How are you going to find out about your loved ones? And it's going to fall to the amateur radio guys. And I hope we're never in the situation where the country is totally dependent on amateur radio, but never say never. And, you know, I want to look out for my family. I want to look out for my community. And I see this, yes, it's a hobby. And it can, for a lot of people, it can only be a hobby. Or for a lot of people, they're interested in the technical aspects of it, and they want to learn more about that. But for a lot of us, it's more than a hobby. It's a service to the community, and that's why I get involved. Now, having said all that, am I on the Triple H net trying to get my Worked All State certificate? Sure, that's a hobby. But I'm also learning more about, you know, building the right antenna to make sure I can reach all those states, and working my radio, working my 35-year-old radio that's able to reach all those states. So my Kenwood radio that I know you love so much, dude.
Well, it's like I said, there is absolutely nothing wrong with the Kenwood radios. They're well designed. They work well. I'm sure the new ones are absolutely incredible. Okay. But it's nice to be able to deal with people who know how to smile, you know, and can then have a little warmth about them and have a little empathy for maybe a problem you're having, you know, rather than just getting your head bit off. Anyhow, the other thing I was going to mention to you too, and we were talking about this on another QSO, and that is, you know, when you go to put an HF rig in the car, let's say you're on a trip, you're going to go somewhere. Well, you can have a CB radio, okay, but those guys aren't necessarily connected to landlines, and they're not necessarily going to have any advantage over you in terms of communication. Now, 2 meters, you may or may not find an amateur on the air. You may or may not get someone to answer you on a 2-meter repeater, which is a travesty. I try to monitor 2 meters constantly, all the time. That sounds kind of crazy, but I leave a radio on, and sometimes there's somebody calling and I can't get to them, but most of the time I'll just stop what I'm doing and go over and say hello, because that's usually all they want. They just want somebody to say hello, you know.
Sure.
And it's a social thing. Hey, I live right here in Lebanon, Tennessee, and welcome to our part of the country. Where are you from? You know, and then they come back and tell you where they're at and where they're going and why they're going through here. And the QSO doesn't last very long as a rule, but it's, once again, it's a social thing. However, if you're having a problem and you're needing to get a hold of somebody and you've got an HF rig in the car, you can go to the 20-meter band. And if you're in Tennessee, you may reach a guy in Colorado. You know, if you're in Los Angeles, you may talk to somebody up, Salt Lake City, or you may talk to somebody in Minneapolis, St. Paul. Nonetheless, there's another ham, another human being on the other end that has a telephone. You know, and you could be off on the side of the road. There could be something crazy happening. Citizens Band Radio may fail you. Your 2-meter rig may be a paperweight. But you get on HF and you get a hold of that ham that's halfway across the country, and you say, I'm off the side of the road. I'm on whatever it is. I'm near the such and such mile marker. I'm driving a what you call it. could you please call someone and have them assist me? And I guarantee you, you're going to get your help. And you'll get it every time. You'll get it every day. If you've got 40 meters in the car, you'll get it at night or 80, because the bands are active all the time, and there's always somebody home. And I see that as probably one of the biggest assets to people who are traveling across the country that have the gumption to put an HF rig in their car. Now, I want to know what you think about that.
I think it's a great idea. I would hope, I don't have it now, but someday I will have an HF rig in the car. I've got a dual band VHF, UHF in the car now, but not an HF rig. But, working on my Workdoll State certificate, I've talked to some gentlemen that are in their 18-wheelers and have an HF rig in their 18-wheeler. And it's interesting because they'll be traveling and they'll say, hey, for the next 45 minutes, I'll be in Pennsylvania. And after that, I'll be in New Jersey. So if you want to call me back and work me in New Jersey, that'll count for another state.
There you go.
Yeah, exactly. We had one the other night that was traveling from Pennsylvania into New Jersey, and so I worked him both times. But you're exactly right. And what's so neat about this, and I don't know that, not to denigrate CB radio, but I'm not so sure that if I reach somebody on a CB, and I haven't had one for a couple decades at least, I'm not so sure that they're going to be jumping through hoops to get me help. I know that if I reach another ham, as you said, I'm pretty darn sure they're going to jump through hoops to get me the help I need, or at least pass that traffic on to somebody that, can help me. I don't know if that's the case with CB. I haven't been on in a couple decades, but when I was, the decorum and the conversations were, I would never, ever be hesitant to let my daughter listen to any communications on HF. CB, no, there's some communications I don't want to listen to, much less have one of my children listen to. And it's just not the case with HF or even, of course, VHF and
well,
UHF.
So. I will say this, there's a lot of good truck drivers that are out there that have a radio on for the right reasons. And when you run across some of those fellas, they'll pull off the road and help you change a tire. I mean, that's just how they are, But there's some real stinkers on CB who'll see you off on the side of the road and come and get your wallet from you. So, and you never know which way it's going to go. There's no way to tell, Unless, and I know I can say this because you're an instructor, unless you've got your carry permit and you've got a piece on you, then you don't have to worry about that guy that's coming after your wallet.
Well,
go ahead.
That's true.
Go ahead. You were starting to say something. I kind of interrupted you there.
I would agree with that. And whether you've got your piece on you or not, you don't want any trouble. You don't need trouble, and you just shouldn't be looking for trouble. But, I someday hope to have an HF rig in my car. I'll be the first to tell you that 10 or 15 years ago, I'd see these guys with a great big screwdriver antenna on their truck or their car and this great big whip, and I'd say, well, that's the goofiest thing in the world. I'd never drive around like that. And here I am saying, well, I'd drive around like that in a minute.
Well, my younger son, Matt, KG4, WXX, has the biggest screwdriver that, what is it, Tar Heel makes. That's Tar Heel. He's got the big, huge Tar Heel on the back of his, I believe it's a Volvo he's driving. I can't remember. It's a bright, bright red car. No, now he's got a gold one. Now the one is gold. He used to have bright red. But it cracked me up because he'd pull up at a light, and in the summertime, you have your windows down or whatever, and this person in the car next to him be staring at this antenna and turn around and say, what is that on the back of your car? Okay. And he'd look at him real weird, and then he'd turn around and he'd look, he'd like pivot and look out the back window and see that. And he would just go, oh, my God, what is that on the back of my car? Like that,
Who put that there?
You'd had to see it, though. I mean, it was just really funny. But, I'll tell you, those antennas get all kinds of looks. in traffic and when you pull in a parking lot, and there he goes. He's engaged in a conversation about why that person needs to get a ham license. You know, it's
my,
like,
my only hesitation is I just know I'd forget about it and I'd peel it off in some drive-thru or something. And I'm sure it happens to those guys. Maybe they sell breakaway mouths that I don't know about. But
well, I think you just become aware. Matter of fact, for anybody that's listening, if you go up on YouTube and put in Matt Aaron, that's MattAaron, Matt Aaron, and then put a space in there and then put in Dave Ramsey, there's a video that pops up that shows Matt at work. And then he takes the gentleman that's interviewing him out to the car, out to the car. And it shows the big Tar Heel, and the guy gets in the car with him, and they make a contact. It's really cool. But, love that Tar Heel. But, man, talk about contacts. I mean, he's going down the road with an Elenco. I don't know what it is. DX70, little bitty radio. With a detachable head and a homebrew linear amplifier that he's made. And that's in the trunk along with a couple of car batteries. But he goes down the road working DX all over the place, you know. And I think it's cool. I'm just so glad and happy that that's, you know, part of the hobby that he's gotten into. Now, the other son will grab one of these portable antennas like the TW2010. You have to excuse me. I got something just driving me crazy here. That's Tennessee weather. Anyhow, he'll go out to the park, and while my grandson plays on the monkey bars and stuff, he sets up the portable antenna and his little radio and then starts a QSO in the park, and people are gathered around watching him operate the radio as he talks about ham radio to them. And I think that's just cool. Everybody's got their own niche that they're into, you know, but the things that they like the most. Let me ask you this.
I have to tell you a quick story.
Go ahead.
I was in our local park, and it's near a radio-controlled airplane field, and there was no radio-controlled airplane sign at the time, and I was in the park, and I was walking a dog, and saw a person slinging some kind of weight on a rope, trying to sling this weight. And I watched for a minute, and I knew exactly what they were trying to do. And I walked over to this gentleman, and he says, "Well," I said, "Is there anything I can do to help?" And he goes, "Well," and he was an older gentleman, and his range of motion was a little limited. I'll put it delicately. And he says, "Well, you'd never believe what I'm trying to do." And I said, "I know exactly what you're trying to do." And he looked at me like, "You do?" And he was trying to throw a weight with a line over a tree limb so he could pull up a little portable wire antenna. And I said, "Yeah, I know exactly what you're trying to do. Let me help." And so I stayed there a minute and helped him get a little in-fed dipole antenna up in a tree. And he opened his backpack and a little folding chair. And as I left, he was trying to make contacts in the park with his little, I think he had a little ICOM 706. But I know he had a little NiCad battery pack or whatever it was, nickel metal hydride, something, had a little battery pack and this radio, and I helped him put his antenna up, and I said, "Now I'm going to be back this way in a little bit. You need help taking it?" "Oh, no, getting it down is easy. I just pull it from this end." So it is funny. He was there in the park by himself working contacts out in the field.
Well, I relate this story to a lot of folks, and I say, you know, I have two sons now that are professional radio engineers, if you want to call them that, and all of that that they do, they have an edge over a lot of other engineering people, and the reason why is because they learn by pulling antennas up into trees, they learn by building projects, you know, and soldering and building up things just literally from scratch, not necessarily kits, but, you know, just building and pulling wires up in the air and all that kind of stuff. And and that's proven totally invaluable to them. I mean, I think it's amazing to see both of them have been referred to at both of the places where they work as MacGyver, because they can just about make anything work under any circumstances. And that's one of the attributes of a ham radio operator. I mean, a real ham. learns. They learn all kinds of little tricks and things, and they learn the actual practical application of something electronic. And it can be related to dozens of different things. So there's a lot of advantages to this hobby when it comes to things like that. And seeing somebody pull an antenna up in a tree, I know, I imagine, from the layperson standing watching, it probably does look pretty strange. But it's not so strange when you start talking to somebody that's, you know, five states away or a continent away. And I think David uses a Yaesu, I'm trying to think what it is. It is a Yaesu. It's a something 17, I don't know. It's a little tiny portable radio that'll run off a battery pack. You know, and
the 817, I think.
Okay, then that's what it is. He's got an 817, and that's what he uses. So he's not having, he's not dependent on AC and all that. And of course, it's QRP, you know. So,
right.
But it's amazing to watch, and it's amazing to watch people watch him, and the interest that's developed by somebody walking by, and seeing that happen is. Is quite incredible. So in your beginnings of ham radio, at any particular time, I'm curious, did you ever do any shortwave listening?
I did shortwave listening before I got my ticket. Since then, to be honest, I haven't done much. As I mentioned, I like to camp out, I like to be in the woods or whatever, and I have a little I can't remember now. I think it's a little Sony shortwave receiver. And I made a plug-in antenna out of speaker wire that I could just throw up in the trees or lay out over some bushes, and I would listen to shortwave. And, you know, that always fascinated me. It always interested me. And this little receiver, you can pick up certainly some ham bands. But also, it's a general coverage shortwave receiver. So I'd, you know, listen to the BBC or I remember, even as a kid, it wasn't the little Sony solid state I had. I had another receiver that I had built from a kit that was a regenerative receiver. And if anybody's ever done that, it's where you peak the feed, you get the feedback going and then back off a little bit. And I bought it from a local company who I think is long since out of business, but it was a little regenerative receiver and had a long wire antenna, and I would just listen. And you know, even the time clock, the tick of the time clock was fascinating to me, that I was hearing that from so far away. So I did some shortwave listening, but to be honest, once I got my ticket, I haven't done much at all, because I'm more interested in being on the ham bands. I'm more interested in a two-way conversation rather than me just listening.
Let me ask you this question. I ask this to a lot of folks, because somewhere lurking in your past or in the in your mind somewhere, you have what I would consider to be a favorite amateur radio story. Either something that's happened to you or something that's happened to another ham that you heard about. And I'm just curious, you've got one or two of those by any chance?
I don't know that I have a favorite. I will say that I think it will probably be my favorite at some point in my life, or if it's not already, my first HF contact. And I think everybody remembers that. And my first HF contact using this 35-year-old radio ever was not in the United States. It wasn't within Texas. It was a gentleman in Italy. And I tell you what, for your first HF contact, that's something you don't soon forget. And the fact that it was in Italy just made it that much more special. And, you know, I was still learning how to use this radio and wasn't sure I was actually getting out. I mean, I was making the needle move, but I wasn't sure anybody was hearing me on my antenna. And to be answered back from a gentleman in Italy for my first HF contact was something special. So that right now is my favorite amateur story, and will probably stay there for a while. Now, who knows? Something could surpass that in the future, but that's it for now.
What was, just curious, what was the rig you were running at the time?
This TS-530S, this Kenwood hybrid rig.
And you had what kind of an antenna?
The antenna that I'm using right now is a inverted V dipole. It's only about 30 feet in the air. It comes off of a surplus fiberglass antenna mast. I think every ham radio operator has a bunch of those around. A surplus military fiberglass and mast that runs up the side of my brick chimney. And it's up about 30 feet in the air at the center point and then slopes down on either end, of course. And it's a homemade wire dipole and still works like a champ.
Now, the ends of this thing, there are the feed point is at the center, at the very top of the pole, and then
correct.
and then the both sides of what you'd consider to be the dipole are coming down, in other words, at an angle, and then you have an insulator that ties the antenna's tied to that, and then a rope or something is guide to the ground. Is that the way this works?
Yes. The ends are probably about 6 feet off the ground, and the wire is held, not taut, but a little bit tensioned with some bungee cords, so it will give a little bit in the wind, so the wind doesn't take it down or tear up the wire. Has little ceramic insulators on each end, and then a one-to-one bound with a lightning protector at the center point that's about 5 feet taller than my chimney. One of my wife's concerns when I first put it up. Well, congratulations, you just built a lightning rod. Well, I'm really not.
No, not really.
Not really, but I could understand her concern because it would seem that way. But I've got a big enough backyard. It's in the backyard. I've got a big enough backyard that I can do that. And the main goal was to keep it out of the way of me walking around, and I've got a garden back there, vegetable garden, and more importantly, to keep it out of the way of my dogs, because my two hounds, if they know it's something that belongs to me, they'll want to destroy it just for the sport. So,
well, you know, I've had a number of those antennas, the inverted Vs, and they work really well. And if they're low to the ground, they are cloud burners. I mean, from the standpoint of 40 and 80 meters, if you take a quad loop reflector and put that very close to the ground and surround that antenna with that, you would just be amazed at people will think you're running some huge amplifier within, you know, 300 miles of your station, but really you're not. You've just got that quad loop reflector. And a fellow that used to do that really turned me on to that was a fellow by the name of Phil Sissom. Now, he has since passed away. He was in Paducah, Kentucky. And his call sign was WB4MPE. MPE, because I remember he used to say Mexico, Panama, Ethiopia. When he'd come, W4MPE. And I think the guys on 75 meters affectionately referred to him as the puke, and that came from calling him the puke of Paducah. Anyhow, which is a carryover from the Grand Ole Opry, the Duke of Paducah. Anyways, but he had this quad loop reflector, and I remember going to his home, and I said, "What are you running here?" And he says, "All I've got's my little Drake L4B." I said, "Oh, come on, you got something bigger than that in here." And he said, "Well, go look." And I just went through the whole place. I followed the coax all the way outside, everything. I thought he had a big amp somewhere hidden, you know, because he had a signal that would just, you know, stop a freight train. And all it was. And he took me outside and he said, "Well, let me show you my secret." And at one point in time, there was a story, and I don't know whether or not it has to be true because he told it. At one point in time, the FCC had actually parked a monitoring vehicle somewhere, and they were listening to him because they suspected that he was running illegal power. And but it wasn't. All it was that quad loop reflector. And so I guess maybe they, I don't know, they were probably looking at field strength and realized that, now, this wasn't anything, you know, unusual, because field strength doesn't lie. And but boy, oh boy, I remember listening in Michigan, listening to his signal, and I mean, he'd be 40 over S9, and I mean, just absolutely, as the Citizens Band people would say, treetop tall, you know. But he was a school teacher, living in Paducah, Kentucky. Went and had dinner with him once or twice. And just an incredibly nice gentleman. Operated on the 75-meter band quite a little bit. W4MPE. For some reason, I don't know why I got a block on his call sign. But he'd go to tune up and get on the air, and he would say, Whiskey for Mexico, Panama, Ethiopia. Although he was a character. But see, it's some of them guys. I mean, he was up in years when I met him. But he already knew tricks that those younger guys, we didn't know anything about that. You know, you read all these handbooks and everything, but then you go out and look at what he built, and that you would swear looking at it, there's no way this could work, you know. But it does. And
And, you know, I heard when I first got into this that, you know, it's all about the antenna. And I don't know that I took it that seriously. But probably 2 weeks ago, my first contact with Hawaii was a gentleman that participates in the Triple H net that was running 10 watts. And we made a great contact, exchanged signal reports, and he was calling from the Big Island, Hawaii, using 10 watts from his backyard. And it truly is all about the antenna. And, you know, I had always heard it. But to see it illustrated, or as you mentioned, your son in his car with his 5 watts and his 817, it really is all about the antenna. And, of course, the troposphere, the atmospheric conditions certainly help. But I used to think it was all about wattage, and you had to have the biggest and best and, you know, had to be running, you know, 240 volts through your panel, and that's just not the case at all. It truly is all about the antenna.
Oh, yeah, and I can honestly tell you my younger son has learned the lesson in terms of power, and that is power does not make an incredible difference. In most cases, you know, people turn on an amplifier, they pop up a couple less units, and it sure takes an awful lot of power to move that meter much further. And it doesn't really accomplish a lot, you know. Well, listen, you know what? We are out of time. We have talked ourselves right out of time. And I want to say thank you.
That's what happens when you're having fun, Ted.
I want to say thank you. We're talking to Chris Paul, call sign NS2P. And this has been a real interesting conversation, and you've turned us all on to things like NetLogger and the Triple H Net and your ARES group and all these different things you've talked about. Has just been incredibly interesting, and I'm sure that everybody tuned in has really enjoyed it. So I want to thank you so much for joining us, and you're going to have to come back again sometime.
I'd enjoy it. Yeah, let me know. I'd be happy to.
All righty.
We'll keep you posted on how our fledgling Aries group is moving along and the latest and greatest things we've done. I'd look forward to that.
All righty. I want to say 73, and you have a good rest of the week.
73 to you too, sir. Have a great week.
Is it possible that a coffee roaster who has been blind from birth could make the best tasting coffee in the world? Well, I'm here to tell you that not only is it possible, but it's true. If you would like the most delightful, rich cup of coffee you have ever drank in your life, I'd like to invite you to visit the website of The Unseen Bean. That's The Unseen Bean, UNSEENBEAN, TheUnseenBean.com. Jerry Leary, amateur radio operator, shortwave listener, he is the owner of The Unseen Bean, one of the country's few blind coffee roasters. You will love his coffee. We want to invite you once again, go to his website, and that's TheUnseenBean.com. That's TheUnseenBean.com. Here at the QSO Radio Show, we really need to hear from you. Go to our website, simply QSORadioShow.com. That's QSORadioShow.com. And you'll see all the past podcasts up there and other information. But go to the part where it says email Ted and send us an email. And be sure and put on that email, I want to win, because always giving something away. Go to the website. It's simply QSORadioShow.com and send us an email. And while you're at it, be sure and friend us on Facebook, QSO Radio Show, and follow us on Twitter, QSO Radio Show. And thank you for listening. Well, that's about all the time we've got left for QSO today. QSO has been brought to you by Ham Test Online. And a special thanks to our guest, Chris Paul, NS2P. We'll be back next week, same time, same station. Remember, on Saturdays, 1 p.m. Central Daylight Time on 9475. And also in the evenings at 7 p.m. Central Daylight Time on 5085. In the meantime, don't forget to go to our website, and that's QSOradioshow.com. That's QSOradioshow.com. 73.